This is Robert Stark. I am joined here today with Keith Preston. Hey, Keith.
Hi, Robert.
So what we're going to be focusing on primarily today is the recent elections in Europe and some of the political parties and movements that are on the rise there.
Okay.
And there is a number of different ones. I guess we can s well First off, explain the recent elections.
Well, one thing that was interesting about these elections is that there's been a lot of press attention given to the fact that a lot of parties of the far right, or what are labeled the far right, gained quite a bit in these elections, and that was true across Europe. There was UKIP in England, the National Front in France, Golden Dawn in Greece, Jobbik in Hungary, and so forth. And of course, a lot of the left is doing their usual histrionics, oh my God, the fascists are coming. But I don't really think that's what's interesting necessarily, the most interesting about these particular elections. I think what's most interesting is something that a lot of commentators are missing, and that is that anti-system parties, anti-system movements tended to gain in this series of elections from across the board. There were parties of the so-called far right, which is really just the populist nationalist movements of the kind I just mentioned, and which vary a lot among themselves in terms of their specific programs and ideological orientations and things like that. And it was also true that radical populism of a more centrist nature gained a bit. There's one populist party in Italy that did quite well in this election. Also, parties of the far left gained quite a bit. In fact, in Greece, there was actually a far left-wing party that outperformed Golden Dawn. There was also an animal rights party that got a seat in the European Parliament from the Netherlands, a feminist party from Sweden. And I think what all of this signifies is something that I have been observing for years, and that is that the conventional political left has really created a void. Historically, the left was the party of the working class. The left was about worker power, worker interest, labor, social democracy, defense of the welfare state. A lot of different ideas that are associated with the traditional left. In recent decades, the left has moved away from that. The left has become much more a movement of the more affluent wing of the left, that is, the left wing of the middle class, the left wing of the upper middle class. The left has become much more focused on cultural politics and on so-called social issues. And in the process, the left has, to a large degree, been absorbed by the establishment, and the left has become a bit cozy, if you will, with the forces of capitalism, even. And at the same time this has been going on, we've seen this neoliberal paradigm become increasingly powerful. And certainly now that the European Union and institutions like that, these kind of mega state institutions have been created, these are institutions through which the neoliberal paradigm is being imposed on countries all across Europe, and it's happening all over the world. And right at the time that this has happened, that neoliberalism has become so prominent, the left has essentially been falling down on the job and veering off in a different direction. The left has more or less forfeited its role as the traditional spokesman for working class interests and the interests of the poor. And that void that's been created is now looking to be filled. And I wrote an essay years ago, back in 2003, called Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire. It's one of the most extensive political essays I ever wrote. But in that essay, I wrote a bit about how these populist nationalist movements that were growing at the time were not only much more authentically anti-system than the traditional left, but they represented the filling of a void that the left had left open. And I think that that's really the main thing that's happening now with these recent European elections, is that this neoliberal paradigm that's being imposed on countries all over the world has tightened its grip. It's imposing tighter austerity measures and things of that type. At the same time, the traditional left is not there to offer opposition. So people are looking elsewhere. They're looking to the right. They're looking to populism. They're looking to nationalism. They're looking to more dissident strands of the left that are outside the conventional left paradigm. And we see all of these movements of this type growing and gaining an audience. And it'll be interesting to see where it goes from here.
So you don't see it. It's not – a lot of people are saying it's a referendum on one particular thing. But you can't really say it's a referendum on one issue, like, say, immigration or the European Union.
No, I don't agree with that at all. I think it's rather a convergence of issues. I think if I had to pick one issue that's probably the most prevalent issue would probably be just what I talked about, which was the rise of neoliberalism and the imposition of neoliberal economics on all of these countries. I think that's probably the common thread, that if there's any unifying thread among all of these movements, it would be that. But there's also plenty of other issues. There is concern about loss of national sovereignty by individual nations. I think that, and Euroscepticism, as it's called, across the Atlantic, I think that's certainly an issue. I think concerns about mass immigration and the various social and economic effects of that are certainly an issue. Concerns about the loss of cultural identity, that's certainly an issue. I also think that there's a lot of concern about the concentration of power that we see in the European Union, and the fact that the European Union does impose a lot of policies on various countries that are not popular. Not only in the economic realm, but also in the social realm. The European Union is a fairly fervent promoter of what's called political correctness, and I think that some of these were protests. Some of the votes recently were protest votes against that. And like I said, the protests are not coming just from the right as well. They're coming from the left. They're coming from the center. And I think it reflects also just a breakdown of the political class, and the fact that the people are increasingly losing confidence in the political class, and the vote total gained by the center right parties, by the center left parties, collectively shrunk on both ends, and the votes that went for anti-system parties of different types tended to grow. There's a lot of issues here. There are issues that people on the right are concerned about. There's issues that people on the left are concerned about. There's issues that people on both sides are concerned about. So it's a lot of different issues that we see converging, I think.
And another trend you pointed out is that even though any party that's basically quote-unquote nationalistic or opposed to mass immigration is labeled a far-right party, but you pointed out that you've observed that some of these parties have moved to the left economically.
Yeah, in fact, I would argue that a lot of the so-called right-wing nationalist or right-wing populist parties or far-right parties have moved to the left of the left on a lot of social issues. I mean, a lot of economic issues. If you look at the left-wing establishment parties in the European countries, the social democratic parties, the labor parties, so to speak, you see that they are very accommodating to neoliberalism much of the time. These parties that are labeled far-right parties are much less accommodating to neoliberalism, much more likely to offer defense, for example, of things like workers' rights, of social benefits and social services and social security and things of that nature, which are traditionally the province of the left. So what we see is a situation where a lot of the so-called far-right parties are moving to the left of the left on economic issues. And I think that's true of these maverick parties of the right on all across the spectrum. I've seen evidence that UKIP is moving leftward on economic issues.
And I always sort of a lot of people have labeled UKIP a sort of neoliberal or neo kind of Thatcherite party.
Well, they're probably closer to that than a lot of the parties on the continental European scene are, and there's certainly a strand of that there. I think UKIP in some way is comparable to the Tea Parties in the United States. It's sort of a hybrid of traditional conservatism, libertarianism, and nationalism. But I also think there's a populist element there, and enough adherence to the party's ideas, and to realize that the economic interests of ordinary working English people are under attack, and if they want to gain votes, whatever the beliefs of the party's leadership, that may be a separate question. But I think that if they realize they want to increase their own numbers a bit, they do have to address some of the economic issues that have been brought about by neoliberalism. And if you look at the parties on the continent, many of them.
Oh, with UKIP, one of the things I want to point out is a lot of their support is not from the Conservative or Tory party, but actually it's from Labour constituents.
Well, that's also been the case with the National Front in France. The National Front has been able to cross over and get a lot of working class voters that have traditionally gone to the communists or to the Social Democrats. And that's seems to be the case in a number of other countries also, even parties that might be considered far right in a more legitimate sense, like say Golden Dawn, for example, in Greece, which is fairly within the classical fascist tradition, or maybe Jobbik in Hungary, which is also a fairly far right party. Even there, those parties have taken a fairly strong anti-neoliberal line in a way that puts them on the left of the conventional social democrats, the conventional liberals.
And you have this article you posted by Justin Raimondo, but he seems to have I get the impression that he has a negative view of a lot of these parties. And for people who don't know who Justin Raimondo is, he's kind of I'd say he's like a libertarian, sort of a Ron Paul supporter type. But does he label all these parties neo-Nazi parties, or just some of them?
Well, I can't really speak for him, but Justin Raimondo is a libertarian, follower of Murray Rothbard, and of course he's going to be critical of any parties that take a critical view of capitalism. He's very much within the free market libertarian tradition. And Justin argues that the driving force behind the recent election results was Euroscepticism, that is, opposition to the European Union. And I think you can make a case for that on the surface level, that certainly the European Union is not extremely popular with lay people in European countries. And a lot of the results of the current recent election do reflect a strong Eurosceptic sentiment. But the question is, why is that? Is it solely about national sovereignty? Is it solely about immigration? Or is there skepticism of neoliberal economic policies? And I think it's quite clear that there is, given the growth of not only the parties of the right, but also the parties of the left, which take a fairly strong anti-capitalist line, and the parties of the right that have moved to the left on economic issues. You'll move to the left of the left, as I said recently. So I just a moment ago. But I do think that is that really is the driving force there when it comes to opposition to the European Union, is opposition to the neoliberal economic paradigm that's being imposed on all of these countries, along with all of these other issues, along with concerns about national sovereignty, immigration, cultural identity, the centralization of power that comes along with the rise of the European Union, and so on.
And you never see that in the United States. That kind of movement that combines, say, aspects of nationalism with some economic aspects of the left. Maybe you have in the past, but I see basically. I see the whole Tea Party movement and Republican Party continuing to go more in a right-wing direction economically. I don't see anything like that ever forming in the United States.
Well, I'm not so sure about that because in fairly recent times, we have seen movements that have emerged in the United States that take a more populist approach to economics. Now, maybe not in recent years, but...
Yeah, that's what I meant in recent years. I mean, maybe in the past, but not in the current political environment.
Okay, I see. Well, as recently as, say, the 1990s, we had the Ross Perot movement.
Yes,
we had the Pat Buchanan movement. But one thing, though, that I think is interesting, in fact, it's one of the most interesting things I see going on in the United States right now, is this effort that Ralph Nader is making to pull aspects of the libertarian and conservative right together with aspects of the left around some common issues of agreement, which include some populist, economic reforms, as well as foreign policy and civil liberties issues and things of that nature, opposing political corruption within the political institutions, making the governmental process more accountable, opening up the electoral system a little bit. Nader's really been out there pushing these ideas, and they're starting to get written up in a lot of the press across the spectrum, in the liberal press and the left press, as well as in the right. I saw a somewhat favorable view of Nader's book on this in the Washington Times, just a straight, movement conservative publication. So it'll be interesting to see where Nader goes with this. And I think that there's something to what Nader's talking about. It's really the same set of ideas that I've talked about for years, that there needs to be greater collaboration between the left and the right on these areas of common agreement, of foreign policy, on a lot of economic questions, on a lot of civil liberties issues, on a lot of institutional issues, even though obviously the disagreements on social matters are going to always be there, on, abortion, for example, or gay marriage or whatever. But that doesn't mean there can't be collaboration on other kinds of issues. And I've been arguing for things like that for quite some time, and it's I feel somewhat vindicated now that a somewhat venerated figure like Nader is actually trying to bring these ideas into the mainstream. And I'm starting to see ideas like this being written about in publications like the American Conservative and so forth. So it looks like it may be starting to happen.
So I know you've been talking a lot about this. Ralph Nader has a new a new book out, and so he actually lists issues where the far right or the far left can agree with each other against the establishment. It's kind of I mean, have you heard of that thing called the horseshoe theory?
I have not, no.
Well, the horseshoe theory is, and I think the person who created it was part of the establishment. I think they're attacking the far right and the far left, but they're trying to say, like, oh, those crazies in the far right and the crazies in the far left actually agree with each other in a lot of things. So the connotation is negative, is what I'm getting at. But what are a list of issues that Ralph Nader lists that the right wing and the left wing can agree upon?
Well, one that he's very interested in is foreign policy, and the use of the executive branch of the government to unilaterally institute military action. There are critics of that on the left and among traditional conservatives and libertarians as well. So foreign policy is one. The war on drugs is another one. That's something that's increasingly being criticized by both the dissident strands of the right and the left. Also, the fact that the corporate power has so much control over the political process itself. I think that's really the heart and soul of Nader's critique of the system, and is that the political class are really just flunkies and stooges for the corporate system. And it's not really a system of capitalism. It's not really a system of socialism. It's this kind of corporatist system, this kind of neoliberal system, where the politicians are really just puppets for the corporate class, and I think he wants to find ways to break that up and rein that in a little bit. That's really the gist of Nader's ideas. He's talking about a lot of the civil liberties issues, particularly the issues that have come about as a result of the war on terrorism and things like that in recent years. And then there's a lot of economic issues. I think a big one is raising the minimum wage. I think Nader's really pushing for raising the minimum wage. There are conservatives now who've come out for
Yeah,
raising.
I mean, do you know who Walter Jones is? Walter Jones is he's a Republican congressman from North Carolina who's fairly paleo-conservative, but he actually came out in favor of raising the minimum wage.
Well, Walter Jones is an interesting character because back when the war in Iraq began, he was actually the guy who came up with the term freedom
Yeah,
fries.
yeah.
Yeah, and then eventually he did an about face on the Iraq War, became an outspoken critic of it. In fact, he even endorsed Vincent Bugliosi's proposal to put the leading figures of the Bush administration on trial for war crimes, and he continues to endorse that point of view. And Jones now has developed, he's still very much a staunch conservative, but he's also become something of a maverick within the Republican Party, even to the point that the Republican Party establishment has tried to unseat him by calling him a liberal and things like that, which is ridiculous if you know anything about the guy's politics. But he is, crossing over into this kind of populist framework that that Nader also was trying to outline.
So what I said earlier, as I said, I don't see a large movement based on these ideas, but it very well could be a large movement in the future if you get together the right group of maybe some charismatic leaders. But right now, I just see sort of the, like right now you see the Tea Party and you see Occupy Wall Street, but it would be interesting to see, like, say Hillary Clinton gets elected. And Hillary Clinton is one of those, she's comparable to what you were talking about. So if Hillary becomes president, I could see that trend definitely growing in the future.
Well, Nader's actually been attacking Hillary Clinton quite a bit, attacking her as a corporatist and as a militarist. And I do think that if she were to become the Democratic Party candidate, I don't think that the serious left would have much enthusiasm for the mainstream progressive left would. I mean, in the sense of, the first woman president and all that, and defeat the Republicans at all costs, that kind of outlook that they hold to. But I think the more serious left would be very opposed to a Hillary presidency.
Than Obama.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think more so than Obama. Because she's somewhat more rightward leaning on foreign policy and economics than Obama, but she represents the tradition or the strand within the Democratic Party that comes out of the Democratic Leadership Council, which was created specifically for the purpose of moving the Democratic Party rightward on economic and foreign policy issues and away from the kind of George McGovern influenced left that tended to dominate the party's apparatus in the 70s and the 80s. And so there's actually something of a conflict between the wing of the Democratic Party that Hillary comes from and the more serious left wing of the Democratic Party, and certainly the left wing that's outside the Democratic Party, the far left. So I think, though, the one thing that's interesting is the way that Nader's book and Nader's ideas have been getting a lot of respectful attention all over the spectrum. Now, some of that may have to do with the fact that he is such a venerated figure. Even some conservatives like him, some libertarians like him. He's certainly something of an American icon. But I've seen favorable or somewhat favorable reviews of his books in the mainstream liberal press and the mainstream conservative press, in the more, a little bit further left. I've seen favorable discussion of what Nader is talking about. Nader himself has been published in the American Conservative discussing these ideas, as well as in publications like The Nation. And so it'll be interesting to see if any kind of convergence of this type does come into being. And it's something, like I said, that I've been arguing for a long time, and I think it's very much necessary if any of these wider issues are going to be addressed.
And back to the issue of Europe. There was an article you posted from the BBC News. It was titled "The French National Front, Far Right or Hard Left."
Yeah, well, that's something that, like I was saying earlier, it's interesting to see how far left some of these parties, these so-called right-wing parties in Europe, have moved on economic questions. And that particular article talks a bit about how the National Front has been able to pick up a lot of socialist and communist voters from the far left. And if you look at the policies that these populist nationalist parties advocate on economics, they're certainly to the left of the neoliberal paradigm that a lot of the social democratic parties have endorsed. Like in France, for example, the National Front is to the left of the socialists on economic party on economic policies. And all they're really doing, all these parties are really doing, is simply defending social benefits, minimum wages, union rights, things of that type. as well as opposing mass immigration during a time of high unemployment, which is something that would have been uncontroversial on the left, a few generations ago. Now the left, the mainstream left or the establishment left, has really become, as I said, it's become a more of an upper middle class, left wing of the middle class party or movement, oriented towards cultural politics and things like that. And it has left this void open where no one is really representing the interests of the working class and so forth anymore. And the this kind of populist nationalism that some of these groups represent has been able to come in and fill that void to some degree.
How much of an influence could the European parties have on American politics? Or do you think American voters are maybe have a sense of skepticism towards European politics or European ideas? Or do you think they could have an influence on America?
Well, there's a lot of different things to be considered there. First of all, we have to consider that America has this winner-take-all electoral system. We don't have a parliamentary system where parties get seats based on the proportion they receive in a general election. So that right there is a barrier to the growth of minor parties in the United States. And of course, you know, minor parties in the United States normally perform very poorly in general elections, unless you have some third party or independent candidate who's already a very well-known figure, like say George Wallace in 1968, or say someone who has lots of money of
like
his
Ross
own
Perot.
Spend, like Ross Perot, exactly. I mean, with the exception of figures like that, it's very difficult for independent and minor party candidates to become competitive in American politics. So the structural and institutional differences are the first thing that have to be considered. Now, as for the ideas of there being a convergence of left and right factions around some of these issues, that can happen on a lot of different levels. It can happen within the context of the system, where you have Democrats and Republicans and liberals and conservatives in the Congress and all that, or even in state legislatures at the regional level, forming blocks around some of these kinds of issues, like raising the minimum wage or anti-war issues or things like that, in a way that defies the leadership of their respective political parties. Now, that's the kind of thing that Ralph Nader tends to be arguing for. You can also see this happening, though, in a way that is outside the system. You can see a convergence of left and right elements that are outside the two major parties converging around common areas of agreement. You know, there's been some collaboration in past times between libertarians and the anti-war left, or paleoconservatives and the anti-war left, or the anti-globalization left. There may be more of that in the future. Another issue, though, is that American political culture is somewhat different than European political culture, in that you don't really have the kind of strand of populist nationalism as an established tradition in the United States to the degree that you do in Europe. You know, America is very much a classical liberal country. What passes for conservatism in the United States is really a branch of classical liberalism, or at least the dominant strand of conservatism. In fact, you know, of all the European countries, the one that's probably the most similar to the United States is England. And it's no coincidence there that the maverick party there, UKIP, has that same kind of strand to it. It's sort of a a quasi-classical liberal free market conservative party.
Yeah, and the other thing about UKIP is they're civic nationalist, but they go out of their way to prove that they're not racist. They even forbid people who used to be involved in the British Nationalist Party from being involved in UKIP.
Well, yeah, the National Front has moved in that direction to a lesser degree as well. I think that the party under Marine Le Pen's leadership purged some former associates of her father that were associated with the far right. I actually posted an article on attackthesystem.com recently about the growing ethnic diversity of the National Front in France, where they've actually been able to cross over and gain support not only from the economic left, from the socialists and the communists, but also they're becoming more ethnically diverse as well. Which makes sense up to a certain degree, because the because of neoliberalism, economic assaults on the working class and the poor that come from that are going to impact poor and working class people of all ethnic backgrounds. So it makes sense that there'd be some gains in support from the ethnic minorities also.
Do you think there is a difference between ethnic minorities in, say, France and in the United States in regards to being open to supporting a party like that?
One important difference in culturally is that the United States has always been, to a greater degree, a multiracial or multi-ethnic society, more so than France. Also, in France, you have this has become an issue more in recent decades, where you've had a very large wave of immigration that has started to change the demographics of France to a great degree in a way that was unprecedented and really which had no parallel in their past, and certainly not to as great a degree as which you might see in it had no parallel to the degree that you have in the history of the United States. In the United States, we've always had, yes, the dominant white Protestant culture, but we've also always had African Americans, we've always had American Indians, we've always had Mexican Americans, and so forth. So America has always been an ethnic, multi-ethnic culture, even if the ruling class was drawn from this white Anglo-Saxon Protestant culture. It seems to me that it would probably be easier for a populist nationalist party to attract the support of ethnic minorities in the United States than it would in France, because of the fact that you do have deeply entrenched ethnic minorities with deep roots in American society.
You have basically among ethnic minorities, there basically are. You have the Native Americans and blacks and even Mexican Americans who trace their roots back very, very far in this country, but then you have the post-65 immigrants.
Well, you see the same thing in France, in the sense that a lot of to the degree that the populist parties have been able to attract the attention of ethnic minorities, favorable attention of ethnic minorities, it tends to come from the more well-established minority groups or from the children of well-established minority groups that have been here for several generations now, since the 60s or the 70s, as opposed to the more recent immigrants. That's something that tends to happen in societies where you have a lot of immigration, in that you'll have one wave of immigrants where that wave of immigrants tends to assimilate to a greater degree to the host culture or to the host nation, and then they end up being somewhat suspicious of perhaps newer waves of immigrants that come along that perhaps are not quite as inclined to assimilate into the host nation, by that time you also see some cultural divides that emerge, or some socioeconomic divides that emerge. In the United States, I think one thing that the Republican Party establishment is hoping for is that they can make a comeback, because their electoral fortunes don't really look very good at the present time. But I think they're hoping they can make a comeback by picking up a lot of Hispanic votes at some point in the future. And that seems to be what the left is afraid of as well. A lot of commentary I read from the left is concerned about that. They're thinking, culturally assimilated Hispanics, or perhaps upwardly mobile minorities, might end up playing the same role in a future Republican coalition that, say, white ethnics might have in earlier Republican coalitions.
So you disagree? I guess you disagree with the political scientists who say that because of the Hispanic political presence, that it's inevitable that the political system will go in a more pro-immigration direction. You think there could be a trend where you have Mexican Americans who have been here for several generations who are less enthusiastic about open borders?
Well, I want to qualify that, because I do think that the the Democratic Party will be the dominant political party in American politics for some time to come. And I do think that demographics will be one of the defining characteristics about that, you know, including, generally speaking, support for liberal policies on a lot of social issues, including immigration. At the same time, I do think that it's possible that dissident movements would be able to gain the support of a lot of ethnic minorities if they focused on issues that would be of concern to them in other ways. For example, economic issues, because what we see going on in the United States is extreme class polarization emerging, huge disparities in distribution of wealth between social classes, probably to the greatest degree that we've seen in about a century or so. And the people who tend to be hit the hardest by that include a lot of ethnic minorities among them. The left, the Democratic Party, and much of the hard left as well, has been very ineffective as far as addressing these issues, just like the Socialist and Labor Parties in Europe have been very ineffective at addressing these issues. So I think that a dissident movement that came along, even if it had a lot of support on the right, even if it had a lot of its roots in the right, might still be able to gain the support of some categories of ethnic minorities if they address certain issues that they see not being addressed in other ways. And in fact, at Attack the System, some years ago, I came up with this theory that I called the 10 core demographic theory. And that is that to build an opposition movement in the United States that addresses all of these issues that we talk about, you know, the foreign policy issues, the economic issues, the civil liberties issues, there would have to be some kind of convergence that mixed elements that came out of the traditional hard right with some ethnic minority populations that come out that obviously have no roots in the right, as well as other strands of dissent from different corners of different social sectors. For example, what I call the déclassé elements, which are people from the more affluent sectors who, for whatever reason, abandon the socioeconomic values or cultural values of their class of origin. The dissident left, that is, people on the left who are dismayed by the fact that the establishment left has abandoned anti-war issues and civil liberties issues and economic issues. I think there would need to be some kind of convergence of a lot of these kinds of forces if some kind of dissenting movement emerged that was able to attack some of these kinds of issues.
And this is another article you have posted up here. It's by a guy named Christopher Cantwell. Time for a white male thick libertarianism. But do you know which site was this originally posted on by Christopher Cantwell?
It was posted on his own website, ChristopherCantwell.com. He has his own blog site where he writes his own posts. Christopher Cantwell is a libertarian writer, sort of an anarcho-capitalist, Murray Rothbard type. But what he's attacking in that piece is political correctness and the influence of political correctness in a lot of different libertarian camps. You know, libertarianism is a wide philosophy. It has a left and right wing, and varying positions on social questions and cultural questions are found within libertarianism. And he's attacking a brand of libertarianism that comes from the left called thick libertarianism. And what this kind of libertarianism does is it tries to blend libertarian, free market libertarian ideas, anarcho-capitalism and related ideas, with cultural leftism, you know, big on the feminist gay rights, anti-racist, transsexual rights, you know, all those kinds of hot button issues of the left. And Cantwell is criticizing that, and I think what he's pointing to is an incident where there was a men's rights conference that was going to be held at a hotel, and it suffered the same fate as what's happened to some of the American Renaissance gatherings.
And Cantwell's not necessarily a white nationalist.
To my knowledge, he is not, no. He's more in just the free market, libertarian, you know, individualist perspective. Perhaps something of a conservative on some social issues, but certainly not a white nationalist.
He's
No.
just pointing out examples of where whites or males have been abused by the state.
Right, and I think what he's talking about in particular is this incident where the same thing happened to a men's rights conference that has happened to some of the American Renaissance conference, and he's questioning, well, who is it that's really oppressed by the system? If a particular political faction cannot even gather in a public venue to discuss its ideas without death threats and bomb threats and requiring large scale police protection and stuff like that, can it really be said that a group like that is being accepted by the wider society or represents some kind of hegemonic point of view? Because
And
that's
a lot of libertarians would actually defend, say that if those groups, libertarians would not advocate throwing people in jail, but they would still say that it's okay that the groups are basically socially marginalized.
Well, it depends on what kinds of libertarians.
Yeah, I didn't say all libertarians, but factions of libertarianism.
Yeah. Certainly, there are libertarians who don't really seem to care about free speech issues, unless it pertains to the state per se. Unless the state is directly opposing censorship, they tend not to be as worried about free speech issues, say in universities or in the private sector, in the corporate sector, in the media. And a lot of it, again, comes down to which side of the cultural divide they're on. There are some culturally conservative libertarians who, would be very critical of a hotel banning a right-wing group from gathering there, but would be okay with banning a group of transsexuals from gathering there. And then there are libertarians from the left who would think it was an awful thing if a hotel said, well, you can't have a transsexual convention at the hotel, it's discrimination and all that, but would be fine from barring a men's rights group or a group like American Renaissance. So a lot of it just comes down to libertarians, individual libertarians, tooting their own cultural horn on that.
And another thing he points out in the article, he says men are most likely to be arrested, to go to prison, to be murdered, to be raped, to be a victim of any violent crime, to be executed by the state, to be killed in war, to be abused as a child, and to be homeless.
Yeah, well, that's what he's arguing there. He's arguing against the feminist presumption that women are in a unique position to be oppressed or be endangered and so forth, saying, well, look at all the things that happen to men. Men, if there's a war, it's going to be men that are going to be drafted into the war and sent off to war. Certainly the percentage of the ratio of men to women that are in prison is much higher. The overwhelming majority of murder victims are men. What he's just trying to do is shed some, perhaps call into question, some of the presumptions that the feminist strand of the left makes about how women as a class are oppressed by the wider society. And he's, I think, arguing that, well, maybe there's a little bit more nuance to it than that.
And another thing in the news is I know a lot of the media is saying that a lot of the men's rights or manosphere bloggers, they're saying that they influence this guy, Elliot Rogers.
Well, whenever something like that happens, whenever some crazy person goes off and kills a bunch of people or something like that, it's common for political groups of all kinds to step forward and try to use that situation to push their agenda. You have the anti-men's rights people that are blaming men's rights groups for what he did. Obviously, the pro-gun control people are using this incident to advance their own point of view. There are other groups that are doing the same thing. My view on these kinds of incidents is that whenever something like this happens and you have some person that goes off and commits a mass murder or whatever, the blame really lies with the individual who commits the particular crime. And unfortunately, in a nation of 310 million people, there's going to be a lot of crazy people. And in situations where you have large urban populations and large metropolitan areas where lots of different people are concentrated together, you're going to have people that occasionally go crazy and start killing people. And I don't think that is the fault of guns. I don't think it's the fault of any one political faction or any one ethnic group or anything like that. That's the kind of thing that's just going to happen from a time to time in a very large society with lots of different people, particularly in a society where, you know, you have a lot of people that are very unbalanced for various reasons.
And that's a whole another issue why there's so many people in our society who are unbalanced. But I guess another example of this is I know that I saw that the on the SPLC Southern Poverty Law Center's website, they said that the website's storm called Stormfront is responsible for large numbers of murders.
Well, they would probably, what they're trying to imply there is that, well, Stormfront inspires people to, say, adopt a racist ideology, and that in turn inspires people to go out and kill people of other races or things like that. You can say that about any political faction. If you are promoting the idea that white males are responsible for all that's wrong with society or wrong with the world, you'll probably inspire someone to go out and kill white males. In fact, there was a mass murderer by the name of, I think his name was Colin Ferguson, years ago, probably about 20 years ago. He was an African-American fellow who went on a rampage, I think on a subway, and shot a bunch of people. And, the guy was clearly severely mentally ill. And I think he was shouting racial epithets when he did this. And just like more recently, there was this fellow, Glenn Miller, or whatever name he's going by now. You know, he went off and killed some people, I think, on the suspicion they might be Jewish.
Do you know if he was associated with Alex Linder's VNN?
I have no idea. I know that he was a well-known figure in white nationalist circles back in the 80s. I actually remember him from back then. He was in the press in the national press quite a bit. But I have no idea what his more recent affiliations have been.
So your main point is you're just saying that basically any type of sort of identity politics movement could hypothetically inspire a murder.
Yeah, any not just identity politics in an ethnic sense, but I mean religious movements, any kind of political faction. I mean, what about the anti-abortion people? There are certain anti-abortion people who've engaged in terrorism, you know, bombing clinics and shooting abortion doctors. You see extremists of that type in the anti-racist community. You see extremists like that in the environmental community, lots of other things. Tax resistors, Second Amendment advocates.
Yeah, I mean, there was a case in Germany where an anti-racist activist, he was like an 18-year-old kid, but he described himself as an Antifa, and he heard a woman make in Germany complain about immigration, and he burnt down her house and killed like a bunch of her toddlers.
Yeah, well, there was actually a really interesting expose on the Antifa that I actually, done by Swedish television, that I posted on Attack the System fairly recently. It's a documentary that was produced by mainstream Swedish television talking about the Antifa in Sweden and how they do engage in these kinds of violent, unprovoked attacks. It talks about how they throw bombs at apartment buildings that are full of just ordinary people who happen to live there.
And this is more common in Europe than here.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Much more so. And it talks about how they attack some migrant workers from Slovakia simply because one guy had a T-shirt on that looked like an Iron Cross or something like that.
That could be said as a hate crime against an immigrant.
Yeah, ironically, yes. It's a very good documentary because it gets into the background of some of these groups a bit and the demographics of some of these groups. And what it shows is that most of these Antifa, these kind of violent left-wing terrorist groups, are people that come from the affluent classes. They tend to have middle-class origins or higher. They're almost all white people. And in addition to having this very fanatical opposition to right-wing politics, they've actually engaged in violence against people with more moderate political views. They've attacked members of centrist political parties and just right-of-center parties. And they've also seemed to have attacked people at random with no seeming purpose at all. Some of them have also been involved in violent crime, just of an ordinary nature, robberies and things of that nature. Some of them exhibit fairly severe mental disturbance. So, it's a very for those listeners that haven't seen this, it is on the AttackTheSystem.com website. It's a documentary by Swedish Television on the Antifa that goes into a great deal of activities about what these kinds of groups are really about, and it shows that. Contrary to their claims that they're fighting against social injustice and racism and oppression and fascism and things like that, you know, they have all they meet all the stereotypes of what a violent right-wing fascist party is supposed to be. They engage in random violence against innocent people. They attack people with very middle-of-the-road or non-offensive political views at all. They engage in routine criminality. They include within their ranks a lot of people with severe psychological disturbances. They've been responsible for injuring innocent people that have nothing to do with their cause. And they're people that come from relatively privileged backgrounds for the most part.
So before I wrap up the show, is there anything else you'd like to add about some of the issues we covered?
The main thing that I take from the recent European election is the fact that anti-system movements are growing. It was interesting to see not only the populist nationalist parties gaining in terms of popularity, and of course there's a lot of different ideological differences among those as well. It's a mistake to group them all together in the same category. But also parties of the far left were gaining, the dissident left, as well as just radical populist parties were gaining as well. And I think that this shows that as the neoliberal paradigm has really started to become entrenched in institutions, a lot of resistance to this is growing, and it does create windows of opportunity for further resistance. And perhaps some of these movements now can be something of a transitional phase to something that's more radical. Perhaps what's going on in Europe might be a model for something in the United States, like what Ralph Nader is talking about. And, of course, that's what we talk about at AttackTheSystem.com. We talk about a lot of these kinds of ideas, only applying them in an even more radical way as well. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the future.
Well, Keith, thanks for being on.
All right. Thank you, Robert.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.